Survival Podcast is always one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, August the 27th. I think I have that right anyway, because I'm recording this on August the 24th. Because I'm going on the road, I'm heading up to West Virginia. A quick reminder about that right away. As you're listening to this, or you're 2 days away from it, if you listen to it as published anyway, Saturday, the 29th of August, I will be at the West Virginia Homeschool Convention, and I will be doing a keynote address on using AI for homeschool. And it will benefit anybody, because it's really about how to use AI to learn and how to use AI to teach. Those are valuable skills no matter what. Homeschooling is totally worth supporting, even if you don't have kids, if your kids are past school, even if you're not going to homeschool. Homeschooling is one of those things, it benefits everybody in the education system because it's an option. And at least it's a viable alternative, and therefore it's some level of competition with the monopoly of the state. Think of it like the fact that you can self-custody Bitcoin benefits you even if you don't self-custody Bitcoin. And we have a Bitcoin question today that has a lot to do with self-custody and custody for the future as well. What all do we have today? Oh, yeah, on the meetup real quick before I tell you what we got today. Remember that not only do we have the convention, which runs from 9 to 5 on the 29th in Charleston, West Virginia, there's also a meetup from 6:30 to 9:30 at the Brick Salt Kitchen Grill at the Marriott Town Center. That is my hotel. So I have that going on as well. You can just go to the site and scroll down below the episode today, and you should see all the information about the West Virginia meetup. And there's a link in today's episode too. That's, you know, for people that are near West Virginia, Charleston, what have you. If you want to drive in for it, it'll be a good day, I promise you. All right, so here's what we're talking about. Trump promised us a golden age economically. And he's run up in two terms now, well, one and a half, really, $40 trillion debt, 29% of it's under him. And I'm not going to disagree with Dr. Paul or Chris Rossini on this one at all, except that I'm going to say that the next president will run up more debt no matter what initial comes after their name. And I'll tell you why, and some of you already know. Chef Ken Daniels will talk about Gravlox and what that is and why you should care. It has to do with salmon and sugar and salt, and some of you, and dill and some other stuff, and some of you just figured out basically what it is. But it's not lox. It's different. Ken will tell you how. And it's not smoked. Ken will tell you why. And you might be able to eat some of it if you come to my workshop in November. Maybe I'll say something about that today. Maybe I won't. We'll have to wait and find out. Mike Melito will talk about setting up your own home shooting range. Nick Ferguson will talk about transplanting nut-producing pine trees. My gut on this one is don't. I understand why the person wants to, but I wouldn't. Carrie Brown will talk about sunchokes and beyond just a crop for you, but a crop for animals as well. Doc Bones will talk about thyroid nodules and what it means if you have them and what to do, if anything, about it. And I said we would talk about Bitcoin today, and that's going to be me. And it's an interesting question. This person wants to set up Bitcoin wallets for his kids that they will later be given after they reach a certain age. I'm going to talk about how simple that can be, but why making it just a little more complex will pay big dividends down the road in more than one way. With that, let's go ahead and drop on into it and hear about the golden age of $40 trillion worth of debt.
The golden age, there's a big milestone that was hit. We're in the golden age, the president says. I don't know if anybody outside of him believes it, but this week, $40 trillion, the national debt has passed a new record, a big milestone. Back in 2015, there's a video going around when Trump was running. You know, it was back then, it was what, 16, 18 trillion. And he was warning, he said at 24 trillion, that's the point of no return. We would be Greece. America would be unsalvageable. And then once he ran again, this last time, You know, again, the Americans know. America knows we can't do these wars. We have to pay down this debt. That's, we had Doge, the whole thing. And that's why he was voted in, sounded so great. And now forget $24 trillion, what he was warning about, $40 trillion we have crossed. And President Trump, in his two administrations, has added $11.6 trillion out of that 40, which comes out to 29%. Now, we are a 250-year-old nation, and one man and his two administrations have added 29% to the national debt. And he's not done. He still has 2 years and 5 months to go. So who knows what the percentage will be for Donald Trump of the national debt when he's done. This is all very bad. This is not without limit. The interest payments are getting out of hand. We are, regular people know what happens when you can't pay your interest. Bankruptcy. And it's going to be no different for the United States government. The interest alone is more than so-called defense, the military. That's how crazy it is. And President Trump is calling it a golden age as we're being bankrupted.
So what I want to do is I want to take you back in time a little bit. I want to take you back to the potato salad in chief is still around. It's Joe Biden. We're heading into the Ass Clown Circus election year. And I say something to the effect of, you know, if Donald Trump will get Ross Albright out of prison, that's probably worth it alone because it's such an injustice and it's the only way that's going to happen. And there's probably a few other decent things he'll do. But if you think he's going to fix the economy, fix the country, something like that, it's not going to happen. And I probably said something to the effect of, if we replaced half of Congress with clones of Ron and Rand Paul, both Senate and House, you still can't fix this. You could put in the most libertarian government on the planet and you still can't fix this. There is no fixing this. The system is systemically designed to do exactly what it's doing. And so this isn't really a mitigation because Trump has certainly made this worse than it's had to be. But this is a prediction from Jack Stradamus. And I'm rubbing my temples and thinking like Karnak the Magnificent. Some of you are old enough to know who Karnak the Magnificent was. If you're not, look up Karnak Johnny Carson. You'll find out. And so Karnak is saying that the next president will add more to the national debt than Trump did in this term once it's complete. Whatever the number is, the first term of the next president will add more to the debt than Trump did in this term. And I know this. And it doesn't matter if somehow they manage to make Cackles a legitimate candidate again and she Cackles becomes president, or tard-headed AOC or Bernie Sanders, or if they get over their problem with Jewish people. What's his name? Who is the governor of Pennsylvania? Shapiro, who's probably their best bet at a candidate, but they don't understand that, or whoever else they have on their really shitty bench of potential candidates, or if it's a Republican, if it's going to be either Vance or Rubio. That's about the only two options you have there. It doesn't matter. And it could be anybody. And the national debt is going to grow by more than it's grown in for those 4 years than the last 4 years. And do you know how I know that? Math. This is just plain reality at this point. It went parabolic during COVID, but let me tell you something else about that. Trump, I'm sending you money, I'm doing this. But the entire response to COVID, I'm convinced at this point, was already preset before COVID happened. They already knew what they were going to do. And it was just a plan that was dropped on his desk, and they said, you have to do it, sir. And he said, okay, because he's tarted like that, and he believes in spending money fixing problems. That's his mindset. We are not going to get out of this. We are not going to reverse course. Anything that any politician says about it is bullshit. Before or after or during the time they serve in office, it doesn't matter. It's all bullshit. There is no way out of this trap. The debt itself is money, and money is debt. And so every cycle, the debt will increase, and each cycle will be greater than the last cycle because it has to be, because that's how it's designed. That's not really a pass for anybody. It's actually more, it should scare you. And I wanted to scare you not because I built this show or this community on fear, because you guys know I have it if you've been around a while. Because I want it to scare you enough, not so that you'll freak out, but so you'll let go of this fantasy that someday some magical person's going to come and fix it. There's no fixing it. I think you could pay off like $1 million a day right now, and if you went back in time, you'd get to where Jesus was alive, and you'd still keep going for a long time. Like, you know, there is no fixing this. It's not doable. And again, I think what people really don't understand, the system is operating as it was designed to operate. The purpose of the system is what it does. There is no point in talking about what it's supposed to do. Now, you could have, I'm going to give you real quick to tell you how easy this would be. You could have a fiat monetary system that would absolutely pace inflation with growth in a way that would work. And what it would be is it would be like a hard-coded every year. There's another 2% of the total monetary issuance increase, and that's it. And it was all done by a computer. You push a button once, kind of like Bitcoin without a fixed supply, right? Would it be perfect? No. Would it be light years ahead of what we have now? Yes. And what it would do is it would prevent the government from being able to just spend money into existence to buy things that it wants, most of which only enrich the elite further. But it ain't going to happen. It doesn't matter how easy the fix is mechanically. In a political sense, a social sense, and a mathematical sense at this point, Trump was actually right. There is no turning back at $24 trillion, but there was no turning back at $5 trillion. That's what you really need to understand. The way the system's designed, there was never any turning back. There is no steering wheel. There is no rudder. All there is a throttle. And it doesn't go to zero. The lowest the throttle goes would be like a 2, and it can go up to like a 20. And that's all there is. Faster, slower, or very fast. That's it. That's all we have. Anyway, with that, let's move on to something more useful. Like, what is Gravlox? Do you want some? Should you want some? Why do you care? Chef Ken Daniels will tell you all about it.
Hello all, Chef Ken here again. In the last segment, we talked about salt-cured egg yolks, and I want to stay right there for a minute because once you understand what happened to that egg yolk, Gravlax starts making a whole lot more sense. We took something wet and highly perishable, surrounded it with salt and sugar, and kept it cold and gave it time. The cure pulled most of that moisture from the yolk, changed its texture, and concentrated its flavor, and eventually gave us an entirely new ingredient. So let's take that same basic lesson and move over to fish. Today we're making Gravlax. And Gravlax, or Gravlax in Swedish, is Scandinavian cured salmon. Now, the name itself tells us quite a bit. Lax means salmon. Gravad means to bury or dig, and the traditional story traces the technique back to Scandinavian fishermen preserving salmon with salt and burying it in the cool ground or sand, where it underwent a very different preservation process from the Gravlax we make today. And that's very important distinctions. Historical Gravlax was not necessarily the beautiful dill-covered salmon you're going to find at brunch. Older Scandinavian fish preservation could involve salting and conditions that allowed fermentation. Refrigeration obviously wasn't an option. Salt wasn't being used because somebody thought it would make a lovely appetizer with creme fraiche. It was being used because fish spoils. Winters are long, and human beings need ways to extend the usefulness of a seasonal food supply. That broader Scandinavian preservation culture makes perfect sense when you consider the environment. Before refrigeration, curing, drying, fermenting, and other preservation methods weren't culinary affectations. They were practical ways of carrying food through periods when fresh ingredients weren't available. And over time, Gravlax evolved. The modern version isn't buried in the backyard, and I'm certainly not asking you to do that. Modern Gravlax is refrigerated salmon cured primarily with salt and sugar, traditionally accompanied by dill. And we're controlling the temperature, we're controlling the cure, and we're stopping the process while the salmon still has that beautiful silky texture. So here's the easiest way to remember what Gravlax isn't. Gravlax isn't smoked salmon. There's no smoke required. It isn't cooked salmon, and we're not applying enough heat to cook the proteins. And despite the similarities you see on most breakfast plates, Gravlax isn't the same things as lox, and we will get to lox another day. At its simplest, Gravlax is salmon cured with salt and sugar and traditionally with generous amounts of dill. So start with good salmon. I like a thick center cut skin on fillet because the thickness is relatively consistent. Run your fingers over the flesh, remove any pin bones you find, then pat the fish thoroughly dry. Yes, the quality and handling of salmon matters enormously because you're not going to cook this fish. Now we make our cure. And just like those egg yolks, we're using ordinary salt here, not curing salt, plain salt. I like kosher salt or a good non-iodized sea salt. Then sugar. Again, just like those egg yolks, the sugar isn't there because we're trying to make a dessert. It balances the salt and participates in creating the curing environment. For us first simple Gravlax, I'd like to start with equal weight salt and sugar and a perfectly reasonable place to learn the technique. Classic recipes vary in their ratio. So once you understand what you're looking for, you can start adjusting it. And guess what? You just made salt cured egg yolk. You have this stuff already prepped. Use it. And a big distinction with Gravlax is I will add black pepper and dill to that mixture that I used for the cured egg yolk. And I use lots of dill. And if you've got a bunch of beautiful dill sitting on the counter and you're wondering, chef, is this too much? Probably not. Add more. This is Gravlax. Use the dill. And this brings us to the question I really wanted to address today. Do we wrap it or do we leave it uncovered in the fridge like we did with some of our other curing experiments? And for Gravlax, I wrap it. Personally, this is where I use a vacuum sealer. This is my best friend. And if you have one, use it. If not, I lay some plastic wrap on the counter, place a little of my cure, lay the fish on top, add a generous amount of the cure on top, spread it evenly over the whole piece, and then I mummify it in that plastic wrap. And then I put the salmon in the shallow dish. Do not skip the dish. You're going to come back later and discover that the salmon has produced a massive amount of liquid, and that's exactly what should happen. But you want the liquid contained, then discovering it's just underneath the fish and it's been there for 2 days. Then it goes into the refrigerator. Keep it cold throughout the cure. When you check it later, you're going to see liquid, and that cure that started relatively dry may now look like a wet brine. Do not pour it off because you think something has gone wrong. This is the process. This is the way. The salt and sugar have drawn moisture from the salmon and created their own concentrated curing liquid around the fish. For my own kitchen, I'm usually beginning to evaluate it around 24 hours. If you're making four pieces that are individually packed, pull one at 24 hours and try it. Pull another at 32 hours and try it. Knowing what 24-hour Gravlax and 48-hour Gravlax taste like will help you find your perfect timing. When it's where I want it, I unwrap it, scrape away the dill and cure, and wipe down the surface clean. You can give it a quick rinse if necessary, but if you do, dry it thoroughly afterwards. Then I like to put it back in the fridge briefly before slicing. Get your sharpest, longest knife possible. We're slicing almost always across the face of the salmon at a shallow angle, making broad, thin slices and leaving the skin behind. It is not the time to attack it and cut half-inch salmon steaks. Thin, long, delicate. Let the knife do the work. I want to see light coming through each piece, and then keep the plate simple. A good rye bread, some creme fraiche, mustard, dill, maybe some capers, lightly pickled red onions, and you know what? Let's grate some of that salt-cured egg yolk on top. Make the traditional Gravlax one first, salt, sugar, dill, pepper. Then start asking questions. What happens if I add juniper? What about lemon zest? What about gin? Beets? If you add beets to the cure, it gives this incredible purple color ring around the salmon. It's absolutely gorgeous. But learn what the plain Gravlax tastes like first. Just like with the egg yolks, this is the same classroom, but a different lesson. Keep all those questions coming into BloodSugarChef.com. And until next time, this is Ken, your Blood Sugar Chef. Cheers.
So here, I want to add some stuff to this. I want to tell you that Chef Ken is one of the coolest blessings this community's ever received. For him to reach out to us and become part of this community several years ago was a big win for all of us. And there's a synergy here that I don't quite understand. And I look at Ken and I kind of see a person in a different lane that's connected to me the same way my buddy David is. And many of you guys who have been here have met David. And what I mean by that is I'll say something to David, and he'll be like, get out of my head, right? Like, he's like, I was just thinking about doing that this week, right? And that sort of same kind of thing seems to happen with Ken. So I've been putting together some stuff for the fall workshop. And one of the things I want to do for you guys that come to that fall workshop is make some really cool stuff. And here's an example. But I'm not going to tell you the secret to the what makes it really cool, and many of you will have never heard of it anyway, potato fondant. You're going to be able to sample potato fondant here at TSP 26 in a very unique way of preparing it. If you've never heard of this thing, it's super easy, but it's time consuming and it has to be done right. But I've developed a way that you can make it en masse. And you can take out servings as you want and a little bit of pan activity and you are ready for that evening. And this is a very highly elevated side dish that you would get at a place like a Michelin star restaurant in the UK or France. Okay. And fondant is to melt. So it's basically a melting potato. And it's way better than that sounds. It's fantastic. But one of the other things that I've been thinking about doing is Gravlax. And the only thing that I'm going to do, unless I end up having Ken do it for me, so it's one less thing for me to do in advance, is I want to do it where you add the beets to it. The beets is a modern addition, like everything he said was a modern addition relative to when this originally was made, when they used to bury it in a hole in the ground. But the beets add a visual impact. They mean just beautiful red, deep, brilliant magenta color and a subtle flavor. And then everything else is pretty much the same. Well, I think I'm going to do that this year. And even though my presentation is probably going to be like Friday or Saturday, it'll be on the bagel bar that we do on Thursday mornings before we really get started. And by the way, that bagel bar is going to have homemade, locally made sourdough bagels this year, not Costco bagels, which is what we have done because it's been easy. But I have a neighbor that's like 3/4 of a mile by the Fly of the Crow from my house now, and his wife is like queen of all sourdough things. So we're going to buy the bagels from her. It's about as local as it gets. I could probably get on my roof and hit his house with a slingshot, to be honest with you. A really good one, but I could probably pull it off. It's probably less than 3/4 of a mile. It's probably more like a 1/4 mile, I'm going to say. Anyway, I couldn't hit it with a slingshot. I could hit it with a really good air rifle, though. Duck Luke, incoming. Anyway, I just think it's cool that Ken sends this to me right as I'm putting this stuff together. And then there's another secret surprise that will involve Ken Daniels and Jack Spirico at the fall workshop. And it's a meat thing, but I'm not going to tell you what it is yet because we're still putting together exactly how it's going to work out. But that also hit my desk today. And just to have someone, Ken and I don't talk daily or anything. The overlap just is continuous, though. It's pretty cool. Anyway, moving on. But yeah, the workshop. Come if you can. Tickets will go on sale. I think it's the second Saturday in September. Maybe it's the third, like the 19th. It's whatever. The Saturday closest to the 19th is when it is. Next up, let's talk about putting in a shooting range in your own backyard. And Mike Bolito will take care of that.
Michael here of Gunfighter Life Podcast. Thanks, TSP, for a cool question today. On shooting ranges, setting up a shooting range, which is a refreshing difference from questions I often get. This gentleman specifically is a dad with 3 kids, 12 and under, which makes it even cooler. He's got a little over 100-yard range or area in which he can construct a range. Now, a couple of things right off the bat. Make sure that as far as jurisdiction, municipalities go, you're legal to shoot where you're going to make your range. That would kind of be sad to spend all that money and realize you can't shoot there. Assuming that's good to go, make sure your topography, right, your landscape permits it safely. One of your firearm safety rules, know your target and consider its background. With those things out of the way, let's talk about construction of a nice range. Not just somewhere you can go out and shoot, but like a decent range. He also set a budget of $1,500, which I think is a good budget for this. You're going to want some kind of proper berm. Even if it's safe to shoot in that direction, you probably want some kind of proper berm and backstop. couple of ways you can go about this. If you have a bobcat or a backhoe, you can obviously make some earthworks fairly easily, or you could rent that. But aside from that, you could get some old railroad ties. Those work pretty well, like three-sided in like a bay to make the back of your backstop. You'll have to replace the center ones every once in a while, but you'd have to shoot a lot to, you know, get through there. And assuming if a bullet or two does make it through, it's still safe behind there. You can use that. You can use sandbags. Sandbags are a good one, especially if you got kids, right? Free labor. Have them fill up sandbags. Get them ready for the military. But you can fill up sandbags. Sandbags work phenomenally well for stopping bullets. You mentioned 22 long rifle, but even bigger things than that. Sandbags work great for that. That's why the military uses them, right, for bullet stops and other things. But sandbags, they're cheap. They're effective. They're easy to replace when you get one or two that's, shot through. Now let's talk about ways to set up targets. Obviously, you can get the pre-made target stands for paper targets. Those are great. I would have a couple of those either way. You also may want to get something simpler, like old pallets, and you can just staple targets up on pallets. That will work. Doesn't look as good, but it works just fine. But the nice prefab target stands work pretty well. And then I would really encourage you, especially if you're doing it with kids, but either way, steel targets. Spend a big chunk of that $1,500 on steel targets. You might want to get a plate rack or a dueling tree. If it's for you for defensive use, you might want to get, a steel silhouette target. Steel targets are a lot of fun. They also let you get in a lot more practice in a given amount of time. If you're shooting high volume, if you don't have to tape targets or repair targets, you can just spray paint the steel. So again, I would spend a big chunk of that budget on steel targets, AR-500, AR-550, depending on, thickness and stuff is going to depend on the calibers. So just figure out the largest caliber you want to shoot and get ones rated for that. But again, the plate racks, the dueling trees, a Texas Star, that's probably a little bit above your budget, but those are super fun, especially kids or no kids. Those are a lot of fun. Now let's move back to your area. You're probably going to want to mark off different yardage ranges. Obviously, that's super cheap. You can do that with spray paint or range flags. That's not going to cost you much money. But getting back to where you're actually going to shoot from, area, you're probably going to want some kind of semi-permanent structure just for comfort's sake. And this is really going to depend on your climate. Right? If you live, if we're talking Arizona, West Texas, most of Nevada, you probably don't need anything for rain because it rains so infrequently, that's not a big deal. Right, if we're talking about coastal Washington, you probably want some kind of lean-to open-air structure for lead exposure, but a good roof on that thing. Just makes sense, right? If you're in the Great Plains, Wyoming, the Dakotas, where it's windy all the time, right, the orientation of your range may depend on the wind, but obviously you're going to want something to block quite a bit of that wind, so your sidewalls may be the most important thing, but if we go to somewhere that's really sunny and hot, not a lot of rain, something like a camo netting on posts, just that little bit of shade where the wind can blow through makes a huge difference, like when it's over 100 degrees. Right? If you're talking Wisconsin in the wintertime, something that, blocks the snow and the wind can make a huge difference in the amount of days you can get out and shoot in a year, at least comfortably anyway. So those are some ideas of a semi-permanent structure that kind of makes sense. You might want to find some good storage containers, maybe an old Foot Locker. I know Jack just added a sponsor that does containers, but some kind of locking container, not for your guns and stuff, but just for stuff you want to keep out on the range, you don't have to haul back and forth, like staplers, targets that you don't want to get wet, spray paint cans, things like that, right? So have that in your semi-permanent structure. You did mention a bench in your email. I'm going to go on a bit of a rant here. Yes, by all means, have a bench. I have a bench. I don't want to be a hypocrite. Have a bench for load development, for sighting in your rifle. If you have that kid and it's their very first shots, you want to put them on a comfortable bench to have them shoot just to see how the gun's going to recoil, by all means, do that. The bench is good. It exists for a reason. But after your gun sighted in, after you've got your load developed from reloading or whatever, you've got a good load established for that gun, get off the bench. get off the bench, get off the bench. We've become so obsessed in the gun world of how tiny a group can I shoot and then post it on whatever. That's all well and good for data, but as far as effectiveness goes, whether it's hunting or actual defense, how good can you shoot off your hind legs? Because that's the majority of the shooting you're going to do, shooting from your classic shooting position, standing, sitting, kneeling, prone. That is way more important. So yeah, have a bench and use it for the things a bench is good for, but then get off the bench. And my advice is, if they're your kids, teach them how you want, but teach your kids that the bench is for those things, and then have them shoot off the bench. Have them shoot standing, sitting, kneeling, prone. Also for that, you might want some good shooting mats, like some good proper style shooting mats for those things. And that's about it. That's my advice for, you know, your $1,500, 100-ish yard shooting range. I hope this helped you and hopefully many more that are looking at building a range. With that, one more quick thing. One thing you might want to throw inside that storage container is an emergency medical kit, for obvious reasons. With that, thanks, Jack. Thanks, TSP, and have a blessed day.
Great stuff from Mike. Now let's talk about moving some trees. But these trees aren't very big because they're a slow-growing type of pine. These are pines that are grown for nuts. And many of these pines that are grown for nuts, they don't really start to produce cones and hence nuts for 20 to 25 years. And if you've got 10 years into one and you're moving to a new place, it completely makes sense that you'd want to take them with you. What you're going to hear from Nick is you're probably going to lose, if everything goes swimmingly and everything survives, you're still probably going to set back the time about 2 years. 8 years is still a lot of time, you know, and depending on your age, like if you ever, you know, we talk about planting trees under whose shade you know you shall never sit, but if you're ever going to toast a pine nut, that 8 years might be the difference between doing it and not doing it. And so I get it. But this is like right at the edge of when you could do this. But if anybody can tell you how to do it, it's going to be my boy Nick Ferguson. So here we go. How do we transplant 10-year-old pine trees? But they're only about 7-8 foot tall. Because, again, these are slow-growing trees.
Hey there, Nick Ferguson here with a question from Jim on some pine nut-producing trees. Question, is it possible to move young pine trees, and if possible, what is the best way? Details, I will be moving properties. I planted Russian cedar, Pinus siberica, and Swiss stone pine, Pinus cembra, or sembra, on my property 10 years ago. They are currently about 7 feet in height. I would like to move them to my new property. The move isn't happening for about 16 months. That's great. The trees can be moved at any time. There's a skilled excavator operator who's willing to help but hasn't moved trees before. I'm in a maritime zone 5B. Thanks, Jim. I'm guessing you're going to be on the West Coast. So, yeah, it's possible, but it's a little risky at that size and age if you're not using a professional tree spade. So you're going to have to decide if the cost and risk of failure are worth it for your particular situation. It's probably going to be pretty cheap to make the attempt at transplanting them. I'm guessing you planted them for pine nuts, and that's a really decent reason to want to transplant them and not lose 10 years of growth. That's not insignificant. It would crush me to lose 10 years of growth on some trees. I know because I'm facing that exact same conundrum myself. So, a couple things. You're likely to see some serious transplant shock and 1 to even as many as 3 years of slow to no growth if they survive the move. You really need to root prune as soon as the temps start cooling off a little where you live. So if you're past the dog days of summer and you're starting to cool off, now it's probably a good time to root prune them. You don't want to root prune in the dog days of summer because that's going to really stress them out and you could even kill them. But you definitely need to do that as soon as possible to give them some time to recover and redevelop some new feeder roots where they got pruned. Basically, what we're trying to do is prune around them, cut those roots, prune a radius. So we want like an 8-inch 8 to 12 inch section of disturbed soil where you chop up all the roots in like a donut around each tree. And what that's going to do is it's going to loosen up that soil, it's going to prune those roots, and they're going to start regrowing into that newly disturbed space. And then when later when you transplant them, you're going to keep all of that newly disturbed space with all those brand new feeder roots, and that's all going to get wrapped up in your burlap so that when you transplant them, they have a whole bunch of feeder roots ready to go, and they're not trying to recover in their new location. I'm trying to paint a picture as good as I can just with words. let me think about this. Industry standard is going to be around 10 to 12 inches of root ball diameter per trunk of per inch of trunk caliper, and you want to measure that about 6 inches off the ground. So I'm guessing you're probably going to be aiming for around a 24 to 36 inch diameter root ball. That's going to be pretty dang heavy, so you're probably going to need an excavator to pick that root ball up. Larger is always better, and for the depth, you're probably going to want to be at least 16 to 24 inches down when you go to transplant. But initially, for our root pruning, you're going to be aiming for, including the disturbed soil, probably about 36 inches. So you want to go about 24 inches out and then go and, you know, make that donut about 12 inches for, or, you know, at least 6 inches to 12 inches to, so that you have something like a 36 to 48 inch diameter root ball, including all that new fibrous root growth. Large is always better. So, like I said, you trench around the perimeter. It's going to cut all those lateral roots, and then you're going to backfill that soil that you took out, and you'll have those new roots growing out there. And the best time to transplant is going to be in the fall or spring. I'd lean towards spring if you can, because if you can give them like 12 months to recover and regrow feeder roots, that's probably going to give you the best shot at success. When you dig them up, like I said, keep that root ball as intact as possible. Pay particular attention to not breaking up the top 8 inches of soil where all the fibrous roots will be. Look up some YouTube videos on how to dig and ball and burlap trees that are grown in ground. That's going to really help you out. Keep the roots shaded and moist at all times. When you transport via trailer or truck, wrap the tops in moving blankets or tarps to keep them from getting a bunch of wind damage. They'll actually get wind burn when they're trucking down the road at 50, 60 miles an hour. Always lift it by the root ball, never the trunk or branches. Get them out and into their new location immediately. So as quick as possible. Same day would be awesome. Next day would be great. When you get them in, water them in well. Native soil for the backfill. Don't put potting soil around them. Keep the root crown at natural soil level. Don't plant them too deep. Mulch and keep them moist, not overwatered, only light fertilization. I'd give them about 6 months to a year in the ground before you fertilize really at all. Interesting situation. I hope it all works out for you, Jim. Keep them coming. I'm Nick Ferguson with Homegrown Liberty. Do good things.
So Nick, when he sent me the email with that audio, he said, I think I forgot to mention that it would be really beneficial to dose this tree with Super Thrive when relocating it. Now, let me tell you about Super Thrive. This was released in like the 1920-something World Fair or something like that. It's been around forever. My granddad used this. It sounds like something from that time. It sounds like snake oil when you hear about it. It reeks of vitamin stink when you open the little jar. It doesn't even make sense when you know what's in it, why it works. It works. It is good as like a growth stimulator, but what it is fantastic for is reducing transplant shock. Nick and I have both said we do not know why it works. We can't explain why it works, but it works. I mean, one thing that's really high is like B vitamins. Like, why would that? I don't really get it. It doesn't make sense that it would do what it does, but it does. And whether the guy that invented it was a genius or just got freaking lucky, maybe he thought it was snake oil and son of a bitch, it actually worked, I don't know. But this stuff works, and it's not expensive, and it's worth having some around. And it's a really useful thing to help mitigate transplant shock. So I've added a link to it under Nick's bullet point today. Next up, we're going to stick in the growing things realm right now with Kerry Brown talking about Jerusalem artichokes, also known as sunchokes.
Hey, TSP community. It's Kerry from Stronger Tree Sources. And today I want to bring your attention to sunchokes, also known as Jerusalem artichokes. And I know we bring this up a lot on the show. I know Jack's a big advocate of this particular plant, but I want to actually come at this from the angle of not just for human consumption and foraging, but for the work that they can do as part of a pasture program and a source of ruminant, and in my case, rabbit feed as well. So let's come at this from the perspective that it's not necessarily a primary forage crop. But let's think about this as a perennial that's going to help us achieve a whole lot of objectives. So first of all, the leaf matter produces a lot of biomass. It responds really well to coppicing. So it is coppiced by the sheep when they forage it in places where I have purposely planted it at certain... I've put it in areas of pasture that have typically been underproductive or certainly compacted and things of that nature, so they will readily consume that green foliage, and they will also graze it down hard enough that when it comes back just like a tree that's been coppiced, so it actually produces even more leaf mass as long as you give it a rest period. You can't let them stay in there week after week after week, but on my rotation, they usually can't access a patch except about once every 30 to 45 days. The more tender, the newer growth is more palatable and more appealing to them, but they'll eat older growth as well. And it's more of a supplemental thing. I would not try to make this a primary forage, and I would not try to plant this throughout your area. I would think about adding this in a place where you need to work on aerating and opening up the soil. Maybe even think about sunchokes and comfrey working together to bust up some hard pan and start building some biomass. So like I said, do not use it as a grass replacement or a legume replacement, but as a something supplemental. So as we know, the tubers are edible for humans, when prepared appropriately. The leaves will feed your rabbits, they will feed your sheep, cows will graze it as well. And then, of course, the root system is going to really prolifically work its way through your soil and aerate and so forth. So, and of course, our pollinator support. The flowers are going to bring in all kinds of bees and butterflies if you let it get to that point where it will actually flower if you're not grazing it back too hard. So here are some of the areas where I've actually put these to work. And in a lot of places I have paired it with comfrey. I've got some weird little, I guess you'd call it, pockets of pasture that for any number of reasons have become compacted. Some of them are actually like former cow trails from when the cows were here over 30 years ago. Areas where vehicles have either tread or been backed and turned around. They're not used in that area now, but they had been. So I've put them in there. I've got them in areas where the pasture kind of transitions to woodline. So especially in areas that are shaded only for a portion of the day. So south facing would be better than east or north facing. They do want a lot of sun to really produce. Areas that are difficult for me to get a mower in for any reason, I have put them in there. I have put them on a random berm of piled up clay, not even real topsoil, but we had an excavation done in one area. Soil got bermed up, never really got spread the way I intended it to, but it's still in an area that the sheep access, so I plugged in dozens of tubers a couple of years ago, and that's actually probably become my most prolific patch. I can dig tubers from that area and move them to wherever I want more. And then anywhere where having a tall seasonal biomass is beneficial, where cut, you know, doing a chop and drop, letting the animals trample it, wherever that is beneficial. But do keep in mind, these things can grow very prolifically, but also if you ignore them, they will actually crowd themselves out. So after a few years, 5 or 6 years, if you haven't been digging them out or having some kind of impact on those plants, they can actually just become so crowded that they essentially run out of nutrient, run out of soil to do their work. And you'll see them kind of self-thin. So if you're going to use them as a grazing tool, do let the plants get relatively well established, let them get fairly tall before you put your animals on there, and try not to repeatedly graze young plants. It can stunt them all the way back and even kill them. So like I said, here it's about a 30 to 45 day. That's our pretty much our full rotation around the farm. When the sheep are make a complete pass through all areas of the farm, it's 30 to 45 days before they're back in the same spot. So not going to be an option for any area that's continuously grazed. And I kind of look at it as let the sheep harvest this, not let the sheep have access to this at all times. And once it's really well established, it can actually tolerate you getting in there and grazing, coppicing, digging it out, thinning the tubers and so forth. Because like I said, in other areas, in areas that are not grazed by the sheep, basically areas in my food forest, I will cut off the tops of the stalks several times through the summer, and my rabbits really love it. They just absolutely devour the leaves, the stalk, the whole bit. Now in the fall, all that above ground growth is of course going to slow down, and that's when your tubers really start developing. So normally we only dig the tubers out once the weather's gotten cold, and we stop about the time that the weather starts to warm back up again in terms of gathering and transplanting those tubers. So if you leave it standing and you let those stalks, you know, just leave standing dry, they'll consume those to some extent. The sheep will, but it's not as obviously as appealing to them at that point. And I do like to leave behind a good bit of carbon and residue. Those stalks will shelter quite a few beneficial bugs, and you know, it's some above ground biomass through the wintertime helps look after your soil, helps anchor your soil, so don't feel like you have to quote-unquote make it clean at any point. And then we're talking about building the soil. Because it does have an existent, a really extensive root system, you're going to produce a lot of biomass. And all that leftover also contributes to the organic matter there that you're laying down on top of the soil. So it's obviously just a way to help you cycle nutrients. I wouldn't oversell it, though. I mean, this is something that it's part of the toolbox. This is not one of the things that's going to fix everything. I would probably lean more towards comfrey for being more versatile than the sunchokes, but I have found them to be a great tool in the right location. So that's my opinion, and that is what I have learned using sunchokes. I came up with this idea a couple of days ago because I saw that Tori the Mom in the LFTN discussion group on Telegram has tubers that she is always willing to share with folks. She'll ship them to you as long as you cover the shipping. So if you feel like this is a tool that would be beneficial on your land, reach out to her, Tori the Mom. I think her social media is The Wandering Ma, if I'm not mistaken. I think she's on TikTok. Cool lady, so reach out to her. And before I forget, I have added on a foraging class in the busiest season of my life, but we're going to do one on September 13th here in Knoxville, Tennessee. Holler at me, strongrootsresources@gmail.com, if you would like to RSVP to that. It's going to be $30. We'll be out walking for about 2.5 hours. It's always a really good time. So let me know if you'd like to come on out to that. and I'll talk to you guys next time.
Just a little add-on on that one. All the way back, I guess it was about 2014-ish, 13, 14, 15, somewhere in that range. I went up to Montana for a seminar, workshop thing that was being run by Sepp Holzer, one of the probably greatest permaculturists that's ever lived. And when we were getting to the point where we were planting into this several kilometers of hugels that we put in, somebody had brought a bunch of different plants for us to use, and some were sunchoke. And he was talking. He speaks Austrian, okay? And so he's talking through an interpreter. But what he basically said, he was holding up the sunchoke that was just starting to sprout. So he had the tuber that was just starting to sprout. He said, "This is the best plant." Now, you don't think you have to understand about a guy like Sepp. Austrians, Germans, they speak very specific and they mean it. They do not tend to exaggerate. So when he says this is the best plant, at least in the context he's explaining it, it means the number one very best plant. And what he was saying about it is a lot of what Kerry was talking about there, in that this plant is something that you can eat, but everything that we eat eats it as well. He's like, the pigs will dig it up. Some of the animals, you have to pull it out of the ground for them, but that's all you have to do. And basically, everything eats it. You can't kill it. It grows anywhere. It can grow where it freezes. It can grow where it's hot. And his final summation was, he kind of threw his two hands up in the air like the I don't know, like the shrugging emoji, right? Like, I don't know why you wouldn't want to buy it. I don't know why you wouldn't plant it. And even though he was going through an interpreter, by the time he got to that point, you knew what he was saying. Just from, like, you could tell, even though you don't speak the language, this is what he is saying. I don't know why anybody wouldn't plant this, but, you know. And so I think this is really a great plant. It's something I've grown a lot of over the years. And I will tell you that one of the better ways to utilize it for your own consumption is you peel it and you slice it and you lacto-ferment it. And it's delicious that way. It's good, like, as an appetizer and like an antipasta in an Italian meal, you know, like a pre-meal appetizer type thing, like with salad like that. It's good on like a cheese board or anything like that. It's good just to eat. But the big thing about it is these things have that nickname fartichoke, and they do because there is a carbohydrate in them called inulin. And this actually is really good for your blood sugar. It actually has a moderating effect and a blood sugar lowering effect. But it does this because you cannot digest the carbohydrate inulin in your stomach or your small intestine. It has to go to the lower bowel, and it's fermented there. And then this is a very slow-use carbohydrate. When you lacto-ferment it, it's still a slow release, so it doesn't spike blood sugar. But you now can digest it in your stomach and your small intestine. And because of that, you don't fart your way to the moon. Because I'm telling you, if you've never had sunchokes before, you slice them up and fry them like potatoes, especially with some garlic and butter. They're freaking delicious. And a few hours later, you'll start, and you'll go for about a good 12 hours of farting, almost nonstop. It's crazy. They don't silent but deadly. These are the opposite. Loud but neutral. Like, they don't really smell bad or anything. It's just, it's not fun. It's funny, but it's not fun. Anyway, moving on. Let's now hear from Doc Bones on thyroid nodules.
Hi, Joe Alton, MD here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net. New York Times bestselling co-author of the award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and designer of quality medical kits at AltonFirstAid.com. This week's question comes from Jonathan, who writes, "I'm a male in my mid-40s. I'm pretty active and have had no prior health issues and not on any medications. About 2 months ago, I noticed that if I looked down and swallowed, it felt like the Adam's apple was sliding under something, almost like having a snug shirt collar. I went to the doctor and she could feel nodules on the thyroid. The doctor asked if it hurt, if it was painful to the touch, difficulty to swallow or breathe. Answer was no to everything. I had two blood tests a month apart and an ultrasound. The first blood test showed a thyroid stimulating hormone, or TSH, of 0.245, which is low, but the free T3 of 4.0 and free T4 of 1.3 lied in normal range. The second blood test was for TSH again, and it was 0.3. I went to an endocrinologist to review the ultrasound, and he also performed his own ultrasound as well. He said the thyroid is enlarged, and I have three good-sized nodules on the left center and right side of the thyroid. The endocrinologist biopsied the two largest nodules and sent them off for testing. Since the thyroid was enlarged, he was talking about surgery to remove it. What are the pros and cons of keeping an enlarged thyroid with nodules or having it removed? I know if the thyroid is removed, that will involve having to take thyroid hormone medication. If left, would an annual blood test be needed to monitor hormone levels? Can eating certain foods or taking vitamins help? Just looking for other options before considering removal. Thanks for your input. Jonathan. Jonathan, the thyroid gland is a small butterfly-shaped organ located in the front of the neck below the Adam's apple, just where you found it, at the level of the windpipe, also known as the trachea. That's for people who don't know what the thyroid is and where to find it. For a layman to find it, you would apply a thumb and forefinger lightly to that area, or have someone else use two hands from behind the patient and ask them to swallow. The thyroid gland should noticeably move up and down. Let's talk about thyroid nodules. Thyroid nodules are lumps that form within the thyroid. They may be solid or filled with liquid. Most thyroid nodules aren't serious and don't cause symptoms. Only a small number are cancerous. The average age of diagnosis is 51. Most types, thank goodness, are slow growing with 5-year survival rates much higher than 90%. You mentioned some hormone results. The thyroid produces hormones and so can nodules. Most nodules are cold, that is, produce no hormone, while some do produce hormones and we call them hot. These hormones act as chemical messengers to help regulate your metabolism and control other vital functions in your body. The thyroid gland maintains a balance between itself and two other organs, the pituitary gland and the hypothalamus, both found near the base of the brain. When this balance is disturbed, we experience thyroid dysfunction. Usually this involves the production of either too little hormone, hypothyroidism, or too much hormone, hyperthyroidism. Your TSH level was lower than 0.4, which indicates normally that excessive production of thyroid hormone exists, but your hormone levels were actually okay, sort of a mixed result. Hyperthyroidism usually occurs between 20 and 50 years of age. Disease is often not diagnosed or recognized until much later. As I write mostly about survival settings, let's talk generally about what a person with seriously elevated thyroid levels looks like. This is especially helpful when blood tests and sonograms aren't options, as you might find in survival situations. Some common signs and symptoms of this condition in adults are insomnia, hand tremors, nervousness, feeling excessively hot in normal or even cold temperatures, eyes that appear to be bulging out or staring, frequent bowel movements, losing weight despite normal or increased appetite, excessive sweating, minimal menstrual periods in women, or none at all, growth and puberty irregularities in children, muscle weakness, chest pain, and shortness of breath in the elderly. Poorly controlled hyperthyroidism can lead to a condition known as thyroid storm, in which very high levels of hormone cause major effects on the heart and brain. All the above symptoms may combine with an elevated heart rate, fever, and blood pressure issues to endanger the patient's life. Jonathan, you went the whole way of getting biopsies done of the thyroid nodules, which I hope indicated no evidence of cancer. If so, your decision to act depends on if your thyroid nodules can get large enough to be seen or might make it hard to swallow or breathe or cause voice changes. These would be good reasons for removal, but understand that you will be chained to using replacement thyroid meds for life if you remove the entire thyroid gland. Now, if you do or don't do the surgery, you can expect to be tested for hormone levels on a regular basis in any case. Also, you'll get regular repeat sonograms if you don't do the surgery or only get part of the thyroid removed, which, by the way, is indeed an option. You ask about natural remedies. Now, some report the Mediterranean diet is helpful for thyroid health. Also, vitamin D deficiency is very common in people with thyroid issues, nodules, and maintaining optimal serum levels of vitamin D is linked to better immune regulation, which is highly relevant for thyroid health. Concentrated selenium supplementation, typically 100 to 200 micrograms per day, has been studied for its ability to reduce thyroid antibody levels in those with autoimmune thyroid conditions. The mineral supports the body's natural antioxidant systems and the efficient conversion of thyroid hormones. Since long-term high-dose selenium can be toxic, blood levels should always be monitored by a physician. Some find benefit in herbs like ashwagandha, which helps the body manage the physical effects of stress. By modulating the stress response and helping to balance cortisol, the stress hormone levels, ashwagandha may indirectly support healthy thyroid function. Extreme caution is warranted, by the way, when considering concentrated iodine supplements, such as those derived from certain seaweeds or kelp powders. Unless a confirmed iodine deficiency is the known cause of nodule formation, excess iodine can trigger or worsen thyroid dysfunction, including the formation of new nodules. All these supplements are potent and in normal times should only be introduced under the guidance of a medical professional who can assess individual needs and monitor hormone levels. This is Joe Altnendy, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, get your family medically prepared with quality kits and individual supplies at AltonFirstAid.com. You'll be glad you did.
All right, so good stuff from Bones. Now I've got one that is actually simple, but it's also complex. And it is simple if you just want to do it, and it's a little bit complex if you want to do it the best way you can. So let me read the email. This is from Tim, and Tim says, what is the best way to set up Bitcoin wallets for the future of my kids? My plans, 3 kids, 14, 11, 1. The one-year-old is going to rule all in this unless you just keep doing it for the other kids once they're adults. Because, 1 year's old, 17 years of this is going to be awesome. 3 wallets, same amount deposited each week. Trezor wallets. The kids have no idea I'm doing this. My wife is on board. I'm not sure when to give it to them. I'm open to critique. Thank you for all you do. Okay, so it can be this simple. Use Trezor wallets for each kid. Have an address for each kid. Send it to that address over and over again. Secure the wallet. Secure the seed phrases. You're done, which just sounds like what your plan is. However, I want to come at this with a little bit more long-term thinking. First, I'm glad you're on Trezor. It is my go-to hardware wallet. I love Trezor, and I like Trezor paid with or paired with Exodus or Trezor Suite. I generally recommend Exodus pairing with it because especially if you're using multiple cryptos, it's really nice. And as always, when I recommend things, I try to recommend things that will work for the average person, for the average need, right, that has good customer support because I'm not your customer support representative, and I don't want to be. And if I recommend something that's complicated and it works really good but it needs technical understanding and the company that provides it doesn't provide good technical support, I become technical support. Ask me how I know. That's why I've divorced myself from things like that. Okay, so Trezor and Exodus for the average person just stacking for themselves, it's fine. It's fine. Trezor Suite will allow you to manage by UTXO and annotate deposits as such as well. Additionally, weekly withdrawals. I don't know how much you're putting in for each kid, but you're talking about 3 separate withdrawals. So even if it was like $100 a week, that's $33 a piece. Fees are going to kind of eat you. Now, if you're using Strike, and I know how River works sort of, but I don't know if they have as low withdrawal capabilities. With Strike, Jack Mahler's Strike, you can withdraw for 0 withdrawal fees, period. 0. You will wait about a day to day and a half for your transaction to come through, but if you're not sending it to somebody because you're buying a boat from them, who cares? Yeah? And so that mitigates that. That said, Now you're creating all these UTXOs in a very long-term storage plan. UTXOs are your unspent remaining balance on that address, even though it's not really the address. It's just an easy way to think about it. And what that means is that each of those in the future is going to cost more to move than if it was consolidated into a single UTXO. All right. Now, that can all get complicated, and especially with you're giving it to your kids. Now, the IRS says you do not need to record or report what would be called a uniform gift to a minor, and it can be up to $19,000 a year per kid. If you're doing enough that that becomes a problem for you, I will volunteer to be your fourth child, and you can make deposits to a wallet for me for the balance so that you get the full 19 per kid. I'm just joking, but okay, you get my point. Now, this is what I would actually recommend. I do recommend self-custody. I do not have a problem with relatively small amounts being held on an exchange, especially a really good Bitcoin-only exchange like Strike, okay? S-T-R-I-K-E, that's, again, Jack Mahler's company. So what you might want to do, regardless of what your buys are, buy for a year. Then do three individual withdrawals, one-third each, to each child's wallet. Use Trezor Suite. I'm going to give, for people that want to do this, that don't want to use Trezor, I'm going to give you some other options in a minute. Use Trezor paired with Trezor Suite. When that annual deposit goes on that wallet, put in gift to minor name of child in the notes, okay? Basis price, whatever per Bitcoin, whatever the cost is per Bitcoin at that price. Total value, the value of what's in there the day that it came in. Okay. Then separately, keep three separate little notebooks, like just a little spiral notebook, like a short pocket one, and annotate there what you did as well. And every time you do that, sign it. You want to do this monthly? Same scenario. Do it exactly that way then. If there's going to be more than a few hundred dollars a month per child. If not, then look at quarterly, semi-annually, or annually here. Whatever makes sense to you. But I don't like UTXOs right now with a current monetary value less than about $1,000. So, you know, 1.5-2 million sats per UTXO minimum is where I'm at with that. I do this with my own money. I buy Bitcoin daily on Strike. Sometimes I throw extra money into a bigger buy or bigger daily buy over 30 days or something like that. I do not withdraw weekly. Again, I know I preach self-custody, but everything is relative to the total risk. When I withdraw to a single UTXO. And by doing so, two things happen. One, in the future, it will cost me less money to move those Bitcoin. But two, I free myself from FIFO. FIFO is evil. FIFO is first in, first out. The IRS says we can manage our Bitcoin for tax purposes either with FIFO or by UTXO. But per tax year, we can only do one. By siloing this, let's give you a scenario. Let's say this one-year-old. You do this for this one-year-old for 17 years, and they're 18 years old, and they're looking at going to college. There's a very good chance they might say, I want to pay for my first year of college with Bitcoin or something else that they want to do, right? Or I want to buy my first car with my Bitcoin. If you don't do it the way I just said, then they're going to have to base their tax gain on the basis that you established for them on the first deposit, maybe the second, third, or fourth, but the oldest first. If you have this siloed into UTXOs, when you go to send it to whoever you're buying the thing from or to an exchange to convert it to cash, you can literally click and say, take it from here. Now you have full documentation. That child could then, let's say if they were spending $10,000, might pay almost no tax on it at all, or maybe a few hundred dollars in tax, whereas almost 100% of it would be taxable under FIFO. So by having this more strategic approach here, managed by UTXO, silo UTXOs based on how much you're actually investing. But I would go no more condensed than quarterly. So once every 3 months, do the withdrawals. Semi-annual to annual is even better. Okay? It gives you a larger UTXO set per deposit. Just by sending it to the same address does not keep it in the same UTXO. It's the single transaction deposit that does that. Okay? You got me? So by doing that, you preserve a lot of optionality for them going forward. And you do not create a tax nightmare for them where they're like, I really don't know what my basis is. They can literally, each chunk has its own basis. And there's many accountants right now that are very good at helping people with tax issues relative to Bitcoin. In another 20 years, there's just going to be a lot more of them. And the more organized you are, the better off you'll be. Now, what if you want this capability, but you don't necessarily want to run a hardware wallet or go to something like running Zeus in your own node or something like that? There are several wallets that will give you this level of control, or at least close to it. Sparrow Wallet, Electrum, which also works with Trezor, I think that's the case, but Electrum, Blue Wallet, obviously Trezor Suite, and Nunchuck. All of these have ways that you can control down to the UTXO level. All of them are self-custody, but only Trezor out of that group I gave you is a hardware wallet where you have air gap except when it's plugged in. The fact you already have Trezor, that's what I would do for you. But since we're having this discussion, I wanted to give people those other options. Sparrow, Electrum, Blue Wallet, Trezor, Nunchuck all give you this opportunity. Again, I do like Trezor with Exodus, but with Exodus, you don't have that individual UTXO control. Now, there are things you can do if you're running, and this is what I've done until I made changes, running Exodus and Trezor. You acquire Bitcoin on the Exodus side, which is still self-custody, but not the hard wallet. You wait until you have, let's say, 0.1 Bitcoin, something like that, or 0.05 Bitcoin, whatever your number is per UTXO. And then when you move it all at once onto the hardware wallet, and then that will be an individual UTXO. That is good from a standpoint is if you spend it, it costs less to move it. You don't have to do anything to make that happen. That's automatic. But what it still doesn't do is give you that ability to say, I want to move this particular block. Like the wallet kind of makes its own decisions. Then you have to kind of like amalgamate. Like you don't really know. It has to be based on, again, first in, what's your lowest basis. And just know one thing about basis is on taxes. Especially when you're talking a few thousand dollars, pretty much what you say is what they take your word to be. As long as it seems reasonable. Because you're also supposed to put in a timeline, how long have you held it? This is another reason to do it the way I said by UTXO, because it might be that the sweetest spot for your kid to sell some Bitcoin in the future, if they choose to do so to fund their life, isn't the stuff that was bought last year. It's the stuff that was bought 5 years ago. And it could be a combination of maybe it had a price spike, and you've met the long-term capital gains holding requirement. So just the way I gave it to you provides the ultimate in optionality. Individual UTXOs by year or by quarter minimum, that reduces the number of transactions and much easier to calculate. And then the optionality of choosing what to move when you move it. Plus notes in the wallet and notes on hard copy. That way when you hand them the Trezor, and teach them how to use it and the notebook all together, you can explain it. And when they, you know, it could be 50 years later, you're long gone. You have great grandchildren by now. Your kid's a 58-year-old grandparent. And they still have those records. And as they're making their own tax planning in their gray years, they have the ultimate optionality. So let's always think beyond next year, next quarter. Let's think beyond next decade. Hey, one of my laws in Laws of Life Book 2, you ready for this? It is actually Chapter 14, Laws of Life Book 2, make decisions that hold up for seven generations. And I have a 7x7 filter in it. Again, this is Laws of Life Book 2, Now Build a System for Your Life. And the 7x7 filter is we look at every decision and say, how will this impact my life in the next 7 hours, 7 days, 7 weeks, 7 months, 7 years, 7 decades, and 7 generations. And a lot of things that you analyze won't get past 7 days, so you don't keep going. But the ones that do, you better really think about. So always remember, this is not just about leaving things for your kids. Every exchange you make is an exchange you make with future you. You're now shifted gears into fully what it means to be a father. And it feels good when you realize what you're doing. And I want you to really realize what you're doing. You're now thinking in 7 decades for them. Not 7 decades for you. And what I like about the 7 decade number is it's pretty much a human life. Not that people don't live well past 30, but it's usually somewhere between 20 and 30 that we start to really think this way for ourselves. And if we get there for our kids younger than that, then we're doing something really right. And so if you think about it that way, if I'm 30 and I'm thinking in 7 decades for myself, I'm 100 years old. Yeah, I might make 101. I'll probably make 89. Who knows? But it's pretty much the best you can do for yourself. And so all the decisions you make now about what you do with your money are with, like if you're 40, they're with 50-year-old you, 60-year-old, 70-year-old you, et cetera. That's why you got to think this way. Now you're thinking about it for your children. That's awesome, dude. That's awesome. You're thinking 7 decades ahead for your children. And guess where that puts you? Puts you squarely in the range of 7 generations. I know that seems crazy, but 7 generations is roughly 140 to 160 years. Your children will probably know their great-grandchildren. And their great-grandchildren will probably know about you from them. And their children will be the 7th generation. And you're going to be leaving them with generational wealth in the hands of your kids. And that's something to be damn proud of, bro. Damn proud of. So since it's that serious, put these little extra steps in it. Take a look at what I'm talking about. This is important enough that if you have any clarification necessary, email me back and I will do what I can for you in answering your questions. And if it's something broad enough, I'll say it on air. And if not, I'll handle it just for you, because this is what we need more of. And this is the kind of thing that builds family legacy. So again, good on you, bro. Good on you. With that, guys, I've wrapped up another week. By the time you're listening to this, I may not be in West Virginia, but I'm getting ready to leave. I'll be back on Monday. Monday, the AI course starts back up. If by now you got in or you didn't, probably, I'm guessing, because it goes on sale tomorrow for me, which is 2 days ago for you guys listening to this today. But that AI course will launch on Monday as far as actual start date. If you're listening to this and you signed up by now, you should be getting emails that tell you all the things to do to be ready and be ready to go on Monday, because I am kind of a taskmaster for this course. I try to keep working, keep working, keep working. I want you to get the most out of it. I took your money. Tom took your money. We want you to benefit from it so that you're happy that you spent the money after the fact, not just before. Also, I'm going to be in West Virginia on Saturday, the 29th of August. I'd love to have you come to the event. And if not, come to the meetup at least. It will be at the Brick Salt Kitchen and Bar is what it is at Marriott Town Center, 6:30 to 9:30. There's no RSVP or anything like that. If you want to reach out, let me know you're coming. That's fine. And reaching out to me in any way, shape, or form is always best by email, jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com, TSPC in the subject line. And if it happens to be something to do with West Virginia, put TSPC, West Virginia, and I'll know that that's what it's about and give it a little more timely attention. But always, guys, always, 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 I find sometimes DMs and shit on various social media sites and they're like weeks or months old. That is not the best way to get in touch with me. The best way to get in touch with me is email with TSPC in the subject line. There's a 99% chance if it's something you would expect to hear back from, you will eventually if you do it that way. Take care, guys. I'll catch you on Monday with a new Monday Mayhem.
They said you should have a house the American way. Darling, I
dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay.